ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
I can remember when ordering a flat white was a novel experience. Once upon a time, finding a decent cappuccino, powdered chocolate on top. That was an achievement. What's your coffee order these days, I wonder? A piccolo with oat milk, pour over single origin beans, perhaps not a coffee at all. Are you one of those iced strawberry matcha people? How did that happen? Were you following the lead of a friend? Did you spot something on social media, some influencer or other? And your morning brew, well, that's just the tip of the iceberg. We seem to have developed an insatiable appetite for new flavours and new experiences. We're all foodie now. My supermarket once had a lonely bottle of Tabasco next to the racks of Rosella. Now, well, there's an entire aisle of hot sauces, crispy chili oils and spicy marinades. When I go for a basic sourdough at my local bakery, I am suddenly queuing with tourists, desperate to nab an Instagram famous pistachio and yuzu cruffin before they sell out. And between you and me, standing in that cruffin queue, even by accident, it makes me feel like I've tapped into something. Like I'm part of the vanguard of taste and influence. So, how did we get here? To this hyperactive zeitgeist of constantly evolving food preference, this feast of next big things. And who benefits?
Right now, I truly believe that right now, more people have more interest in food than ever before.
Does that mean that we're eating better or well?
I mean, I wouldn't say so.
I'm Jonathan Green, and this is Every Bite from ABC Radio National. It's all about food and the places where food, culture, science, and history collide. This week, The Way We Eat Now with Ruby Tando.
We take this for granted, you know, that we can just open Google Maps and find at a glance anywhere from half a dozen to kind of 500 places near us where we could get some food. And that is, you know, genuinely unprecedented.
Ruby Tando knows food. She burst to prominence as a finalist on the Great British Bake Off when she was just 20. Since then, she's become a celebrated food writer known for astute observations on how we eat and why. She's written for New Yorker, The Guardian, Vittles, Vice. She's published 5 books. And her latest is a deep dive into the food culture of today. An era that's defined by abundance, novelty, virality, and paradoxically scarcity. Manufactured cues for trending foodstuffs from hole-in-the-wall outlets. The prize? Well, perhaps a new taste sensation, or, well, at least bragging rights online. The book is called All Consuming, Why We Eat the Way We Eat Now. And one of the questions she ponders is whether she's ever had an original craving in her life.
I mean, it quickly becomes existential, doesn't it? You know, this question of, like, to what extent do we have any kind of control over our own fates? But I think what I meant by that ultimately was not that I don't have my own kind of deeply personal appetites and things that I like and don't like and so on, but just that the way that I engage with those, the way that I actually make decisions that kind of, when I'm in the supermarket, when I'm in a restaurant, you name it, is so social. It is really, really a collaborative process with the people around me, with the people who I kind of connect with online, with advertising, with marketing. And it's that kind of running up against the world, against these social forces, that really turns my personal appetites into action. And, you know, that's a really connective process.
I wonder if it's one of the things that troubles people about the nature of food culture in that social setting is that the manipulability of people now, all of a sudden, given the technology that we are confronted with.
Yeah, I think it does put us ill at ease. And you see a lot, I think, increasingly as the internet has become our kind of main vehicle for food culture, you see people reverting to older means and craving that older way of sharing recipes, kind of parent to child or within communities, and also craving this kind of geographically specific food culture where you have like one local specialty and things like that. But at the same time, I think there's something quite special about our connectedness. And, you know, we still do learn to eat in a reasonably intimate way from other people. It just happens in a different way to how it did before. It's not in one village. It might be within one community online.
But as you point out, it's been a pretty quick transition. This is a thing almost post-Second World War, since the mid-20th century, that we've shifted from that culture you describe of food being particular to families, particular to communities. It now seems at once untethered and ubiquitous.
Yeah. I mean, it is post-Second World War. And I think I'm not saying anything new when I say that. You know, this has been well established. But I think a lot of stuff that's been written about this transformation in food culture in the kind of 50s and 60s concentrates on changes in industry, changes in farming and trade, and all of these things obviously have a huge amount of responsibility for our kind of globalizing tastes. But I think what we need to bear in mind as well is that it was a revolution in communications as well. And the 50s and 60s are when we see, you know, newspapers having magazines and supplements that have recipes and reach the whole nation on a Saturday or Sunday. And we see the birth of really mainstream food television and things like that. And it's these vehicles through which people learned how to cook these new recipes, what to do with these new ingredients and so on.
What do we mean when we use that expression, and we've used it a couple of times already in our conversation, of food culture? What is that?
I think food culture is all of the ways that we kind of talk and think about food. You know, there's the food we eat, and then there are the stories that we tell about it. And I think that, you know, those stories comprise a huge amount of our food culture. It's about the values we affix to things. It's about the kind of narrative that we share when we're talking about a roast dinner, let's say, or a plate of pasta. It's, well, what does this mean to us? What does it signify?
I was thinking before this chat that there's something about food and something about internet culture that they were kind of made for each other. There's something that internet culture does particularly well that really suits the discussion of food. And it discusses food in a way that we, yes, despite those magazines of the 1970s and 1980s, and despite that progress you describe, the sort of discussion we have now online is something we've never really had before.
Yeah, I think that what's really interesting about internet food culture is that it really is a rupture from the kind of top-down, chef-led or author-led ways that we were talking about food, you know, in those immediate post-war years and through to kind of the 90s. Mm. That was very much a few decades where we were learning about food from big personalities and from experts. And now we've got to this kind of chaotic democracy of food information where anyone can upload a recipe or a restaurant review, you name it. And this feels so unprecedented, but actually, you know, in a weird way, it's a reversion to the way we used to learn about food, which is to say, not from experts necessarily, but from people on the same level as us, people with the same amount of insight and skill as us. And, you know, occasionally this leads to bad recipes and hasty conclusions about parts of food culture, but I actually also see it as a really positive thing that people are empowered not just to consume food culture, but to add to it themselves.
I wonder, though, if going back a little bit in time, it was ever a thing that we really thought about that closely. It was just a thing we did, and from a set range of dishes, and which were fundamentally seasonal, which were particular to our family or our location. It wasn't really a thing that we interrogated.
No, we've become so consumed with kind of food discourse that I think a lot of us spend more time now consuming food media, thinking about food, being advertised to and so on, than actually eating food. Mm. And that hasn't always been the case. When I was doing some research, I found this wonderful book by Derek Cooper, who was a British journalist in the kind of 60s and 70s. And he said, you know, we do not talk about food. He said this in the late 60s. He opened a book about food saying, we do not talk about it. That's not how it works. And, you know, he was right. At the time, it was kind of, certainly in the UK, seen as a little bit gauche, seen as maybe slightly over-familiar, almost like talking about sex.
But it creates in this online food culture, this constant need for more, for invention. And I'm wondering, how does a culture with such a constant need for invention and more, how does that end?
I mean, you have to wonder at a certain point whether we have perhaps come up with all the recipes that should be invented, whether there is a limit to this, yes. I mean, there are just millions and millions of recipes. And I think as the internet becomes more congested with recipes and more kind of full of content creators and recipe developers, you get to a point where they have to compete really, really hard to stand out. And people tend to go down one of two tracks. Either they become obsessed with superlatives and recipes become very hyperbolic, like the world's best ever gooeyest chocolate chip cookie, or they go down the track of riffs and iterations and combining global food cultures. So that way, it might be the miso brown butter gochujang pasta or something like that, this bringing together of things in order to create something, anything new.
It has to be exhausted at some point. And one of the really interesting things you say in the book, it's also a medium of nouns.
Mm.
Once upon a time, we had dishes that had fairly opaque names.
Yes.
Now we have a collection of nouns that describe with precise detail what's in the thing.
Exactly. We used to have crepe Suzette. Where's crepe Suzette? I'm not hearing about that anymore.
well, what would crepe Suzette be called on TikTok?
Oh, God. What would it be called? It would be called like brown butter caramelized orange sticky crepes or something like that. I would guess. But, you know, this is the same thing again, chefs and recipe developers. Like, the role of a recipe developer is an incredibly new thing. The idea that your job when writing recipes is to create something new or to market something new, you know, we didn't used to do things that way. The job of a recipe writer used to be to successfully convey a decent way of making an existing recipe. So this is a new situation that we find ourselves in.
But at the same time, I suspect the similarity between those two approaches is an inclination towards comfort.
Mm.
So, you know, having a better way to produce something we know, that's comforting.
Yes. Having
an online culture that talks about lovely things and tastes and flavour and beautiful pictures of presentation, that's also comforting in a world that has so many other things, especially online, that are far more disturbing. I suspect comfort might be the common factor.
I think you're right. It's very enjoyable. I mean, my Instagram kind of suggested for you feed is just pictures of cakes and ice creams and things like this. You know, there's actually a lot in Australia. I get these presented to me because there's such a robust ice cream making culture there. So I'm constantly seeing ice creams from the other side of the world and just kind of languishing in that imagery, that beautiful kind of craveable imagery.
I wonder, when we follow an internet craving, are we seeking satisfaction from the thing itself or the gratification of joining that online collective?
I think it varies. So I think in some senses it's like me and the ice cream and it's just about consuming the idea and the imagery. But in many cases you do want to be part of something, even if you feel you're doing it begrudgingly or ironically. And, you know, that's the case when...
Ironic eating, that's so 21st century.
Well, here's the thing. We think we can do it ironically, but, you know, let's be real. If you go to, like, the latest viral Dubai chocolate pistachio latte place, you know, realistically, even if you're going to be like, this is so cliche, the fact is you're going and you're queuing and you're paying for this food and you become, for a moment, part of a kind of trend-seeking, hype-seeking group of people is very contagious.
Ruby Tando, author of All Consuming, Why We Eat the Way We Eat Now. And you're listening to Every Bite from ABC Radio National. I'm Jonathan Green. It's true, isn't it? Until recently, for many of us, unfamiliar foods were a turn-off, something approached with trepidation. Now, our broader appetites improve food standards, the ascendancy of celebrity chefs and influencers. It all means that more of us seek out new culinary experiences. So what else is at play here? Beyond access and media influence, what are the key drivers in our modern food culture?
I think that a lot of what inspires people is, I mean, we've talked about like that organic side, but actually marketing, you know, from big companies has been a massive revolution. And I always think about the example of soft drinks and wellness drinks. So if you look at each of these things, we have really reached the limit, realistically, of what can be innovated here. We've come up with all the soft drinks. They're here already. Many of them have been here for thousands of years, things like kombucha, let's say. Mm. But what we're experiencing is a revolution in marketing where marketers are getting more and more savvy about how to play on our anxieties and also our hopes. I don't think it's always entirely cynical, but it's very, very clever. And that is how I can now go into a grocery shop, just a normal one near my house, and I can get something that is fundamentally just kombucha, and it's called like Gut Spirit Revitalizing Sunshine Nectar, right? It's, you know, it's become really extreme.
It is extreme, but as you say, though, it's not innocent. And I suspect that's the thing about online culture, especially within social media, that we think that it's a natural outpouring of you know, people's imaginations, but 9 times out of 10, it's actually a cynical manipulation of algorithms and particular elements to draw a certain revenue extractable crowd.
Yeah, I think that's where the most exciting parts of food culture for me personally are the ones that kind of are grassroots and not profit-led. There are definitely still pockets of the internet where people, let's say, share a recipe or share a restaurant review just because they are obsessives and they love doing it. But I think maybe one of the issues right now is that even those kind of small outpourings of enthusiasm for food become professionalized. So rather than sharing a recipe for free to, let's say, allrecipes.com, so many of us are trying to monetize these things. And I'm part of this, obviously. Like, I belong to, you know, food media in its kind of extended sphere. So I'm part of this. But what I really love is when people just do this stuff because they love sharing in the same way as people love sharing a recommendation among friends.
The sad truth of that is, I guess it's often just there for a moment. It has this glorious burst of innocent sunshine.
Yeah, that's
before it is consumed and monetized, but we must enjoy it while it's there.
Yes.
As you point out in the book, and this is sort of an important thing to remember, we are all born as innocents, as individuals with very simple sets of ideas around taste.
Yeah, I mean, we are programmed to be omnivorous as, you know, a species.
It's in our teeth, and you say.
Yeah, it is. You know, we've got all these, we've got our canines and incisors and molars. You know, these are a variety of teeth designed so that we can eat a variety of foods. Like, that is where we come from. And everything else has to be learned. So, you know, some species just like they eat one thing, they kind of know this instinctively. We are constantly learning how to eat and what to want. And we start off learning that from our parents, you know, notwithstanding a few likes or dislikes. Obviously, famously, some people cannot eat coriander. It tastes terrible to them. But, you know, by and large, you know, this is a social process. We're always negotiating which foods we like and which foods we kind of want to align ourselves with or distance ourselves from.
I mean, that's perhaps the part of the story that starts to get a little concerning, because we can look at food culture in the modern age as a thing which, you know, amuses adults who have already well-defined tastes and expectations of food. But when it comes to the influence it might have on children making their way in that world, I wonder how that works out.
Yeah, I mean, children are malleable, aren't they? And I think you can see even with something like bubble tea, or actually, do you know what? The more pertinent thing right now is matcha is really something that now there are 8 and 9 year olds who are like, will you take me to go get matcha this weekend? It's like, what business do you have having matcha? But in any case, you know, yeah, the kids are really vulnerable to these kind of trends, and they're very kind of credulous about food. But, you know, that's our job as adults, to kind of find a way to encourage the creativity of, you know, having a blueberry matcha latte, even if we think it's maybe slightly daft, but also to provide other ways of learning about foods that are maybe more rooted in family and community, and also learning about the materiality of food and cooking and where it actually comes from, rather than just chasing the end result, one thing after another.
I mean, in a way that online culture sort of misrepresents the nature of food. Food isn't an aspirational thing. Food is it used to be a thing that was grounded in production, in seasonality, in farms and family tables. It's now about being there with everybody else, aspiring to that.
Yeah, I think that, here's the thing, I think that food has long been actually very aspirational, but of course it's always a class thing, so it's based on access. So the second that you have the resources or the time to think about food more and to have the luxury of choice, you begin to re-complicate food in ways that, you know, people don't if they simply don't have a choice in what they eat or they're kind of in survival mode. And so that complicating of food is something that really used to only be done by the kind of upper echelons. And you see these silly, silly cookbooks, even from the kind of 18th and 19th centuries, with kind of sugar sculptures and pies in the shape of castles and all this silly stuff. And the only difference, I think, is now far, far more people are in a position where they can have that playfulness about food. And, you know, sometimes the aspiration and the kind of level of showing off around food.
And yet I wonder how totally true that is. I wonder if, I mean, there is still, I would imagine, a very strong class element in this. If you are someone who basically struggles to feed their family, you're not worried about the latest trend on TikTok.
Exactly. No, that's exactly it. It's about whether you have the freedom and the resources, and that's the point at which you start to play with food and kind of follow these trends. But yeah, if you don't have that freedom, you don't have that luxury, it does become functional again. That said, I would say that, you know, these trends filter down, and so they start among people who are kind of developing them and playing around with them, and they filter down to the level of the supermarket and the level of just kind of mass marketed products, such that, you know, even let's say, you know, the vegetables that are in the kind of freezer section of a supermarket, inexpensive, accessible, nutritious, you might start to see new things enter even into that. And so the kind of mixed bag of assorted veg might change to frozen kale or frozen, you know, sweet potato that people are using in things. It sounds really obvious, but this stuff starts with trendsetting elsewhere in the chain and eventually filters through to those more accessible foods, for better or worse.
I mean, does the pace and ubiquitous attention of food culture, does that mean that we're eating better or well?
I mean, I wouldn't say so. But but I think that there's something. Part of that is just, well, how do you define eating well? Do you define it as eating healthily? Do you define it as eating kind of holistically with a mind to food systems? You know, this trend-led participatory food system, it doesn't really relate to that kind of eating well, although maybe this is the starting point, just getting people talking about food, getting people interested in it, and then maybe kind of guiding people towards those more in-depth and kind of culturally attuned conversations about produce and provenance and sustainability and all of that.
Who does the modern food culture serve, do you think?
I think it primarily serves the middleman. That's what I would say. I think it appears to serve consumers, but I think ultimately it's middlemen. And I think if you look at, you know, these platforms, like, you know, who is really served by Instagram? Is it the influencers, or is it in fact Instagram and Meta? We've also got, you know,
I think we know the answer to that.
Yeah, I think we know the answer to that. You know, and there's delivery platforms, and there are publishers, and there are commissioners. There's also restaurant reservations platforms, which are, you know, quietly one of the most powerful drivers of like restaurant culture right now. So all of these middlemen, supermarkets as well, they are at the center of all of this.
I wonder, you know, what becomes of a culture that is so minutely absorbed in the detail of what it eats?
If there's one thing I've learned from kind of looking at how this has changed over the decades, is that, you know, these things are cyclical and they are prone to change. You know, this isn't like a linear progress. So I think there will actually come a point, maybe in the near future, where people no longer want to be as enthralled to food trends or as obsessed with the minutiae of food anymore. I don't know exactly when that will be. I don't know what will kick it off. But I do think that right now we are at some kind of a saturation point with kind of food discourse. And I'd be really interested to see what happens next with that.
What's your tip on that? I mean, if we were to have this conversation in 10 years' time, which is an awful long period in our modern world.
Mm-hmm, yes.
What would we be observing, do you think?
I think that perhaps one thing that will happen is, because I'm already seeing it a little bit, is people are gravitating back towards trying to understand things about local food traditions, and people are gravitating towards food that seems to resist trends and seems to resist like the constant innovations of food right now. So whether that's cooking from an old recipe book that's a hand-me-down, or whether it's, you know, having an allotment and growing your own food and embracing the seasons, which, you know, they're timeless, I think that we are seeing that. And it's, you know, it's part of the bigger cultural shift. Lots of people are reverting to physical media, like vinyl records and things like that. And food, I think, will follow kind of a similar track.
If we are what we eat, then it's worth thinking about why we eat the things we eat. The chains of influence and preference, the machinery of foodie desire. As Ruby Tando describes, this is an increasingly complex landscape, but in its way, the fact that it exists, what's a sign of caring and interest? For every yuzu cruffin craze, there's an earnest line of inquiry into taste, nutrition, equity and sustainability. It's something we hear at every bite, like Ruby, reckon is a net plus. It's time to talk with our mouths full. Every Bite is your weekly journey to the places where food, culture, science and history collide. Every Bite tells a story. And thanks to our guest, Ruby Tando, her new book, check it out, it's called All Consuming, Why We Eat the Way We Eat Now. You can hear Every Bite on ABC Radio National or anytime on the ABC Listen app. And welcome to Canadian listeners on CBC. G'day. Share us round. This is, of course, how food culture works, you know, and you're part of it now. We love hearing what you think of the show. Perhaps you have an idea for an episode at some point here in 2026. Shoot us an email, everybite, all one word, at abc.net.au. Everybite at abc.net.au. Every Bite is made on Wurundjeri country and produced by Kim Jurek. I'm Jonathan Green.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. You can discover more ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.